in KC-135. Well, I wasn't a pilot, for sure. Always wished I was, but never made it that far. Had to have a degree to do that and good eyes, and I didn't have either.
Worked out for me, but it was a lot of fun. Yeah, I flew the 135 and the KC-10, and it was quite an opportunity.
So you were probably at one time or another stationed at McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, Kansas.
Simon, I was going to ask you what part of Kansas you were from.
45 miles southeast of Wichita. I worked out there at Learjet for a little while after in the Navy. And our nephew, my wife's with me, Bernice, of 52 years. And our nephew learned to fly there at Beach. His mom worked for Beechcraft. And then he went on to fly for the Air Guard out of St. Joseph, Missouri. In C-130s, and now he flies a 787 for American Airlines.
A friend of mine was the active duty advisor for the unit over there, my wife, when we were stationed in Wichita, she was in service as well, but she went got out of service and went to work for Cessna and Beach.
Went to work for Boeing, but it didn't work out that way. I didn't take shop in high school, and the guys that did, they got on with Boeing. I was bucking rivets on a Model 24 Lear for $1.70 an hour.
It's a great place to be for aviation, and just the different places you could go to and all the stuff that's there. But yeah, we were there. Our unit was the first one to get the re-engined KC-135, so we had a lot of interaction with Boeing. They were just right across the street from us, across the runway, actually. And we shared the field with a F-4 guard unit that was there. But, yeah, I spent my first 5.5 years right there in Wichita. It was a great place to live and a great place to have a family.
Had a lot of kinfolk there. My brother-in-law was always... said was like my brother. He worked for the Wichita Police Department and worked his way up to lieutenant in 26 years. And then he became a Boeing guard and actually got to guard Air Force One and two, I guess you'd say. There was two of them there, and they were painted in that primer green. I remember standing under them and looking at them, and they always had two Air Force guards and two Boeing guards standing guard around that 747. I actually have a coffee cup off of it that George gave me that I'm awfully proud of. But, yeah, it was a nice place. I'd go out there in the summer when I was back in the late 50s or early 60s when I was a kid and watch the B-52s and... the B-47s, and the sky was just about continuously full of them.
There weren't any bombers there at the time. We were a dual missile and tanker wing, and but we pulled alert out of there, so every third week you got to go spend time with Uncle Sam for a whole week.
Yeah, I was telling a friend of mine on here, Bill, N4IQ, lived out in Kansas, and I've got some slides from an old Kodak 126 camera of the B-52s when they had the nose cone and the back by the elevators and in the vertical stabilizer painted fluorescent orange. And not many people ever seen them painted that color.
Pod was back there.
Well, no, this was actually on the vertical stabilizer and I think the horizontal stabilizer and the nose. The rest of it was just aluminum. And I don't know if that was test aircraft or what, but there was quite a few of them. In the 47s, they were just aluminum, I guess you'd say. But the sky was just continuously filled with them. It was, I just had a ball on my bicycle trying to get under them. My aunt and uncle lived at 1826 Verbreek. And Verbreek sticks out in my mind because if you ever seen anything with Wyatt Earp in it and that, he'd always go to Dock Verbreek.
And on alert, we'd sent in the alert facility on the front porch when there wasn't anything else to do and look out west towards Dodge City. And the thunderstorms that would build up there are just incredible. We were there one afternoon and got to looking at one and called the weather shop, and that thing topped out at more than 75,000 feet.
The automobile, wow. That's the highest I've heard of up in that area, around 80,000, about as high as I think it's ever been reported. Yeah, they had some bad weather out there. I used to ride that 250 Suzuki Yamaha YDS3 back and forth out there to Learjet. I'd come home on the weekend to Pittsburgh, Kansas, where my folks live. And I actually got blown off the highway there coming out of Augusta one day. And they had that blown out fairing on it, and it just pushed me right off the highway.
Time in around that area, and we were at 30,000 feet, and a bug hit the windshield. And I remember looking at my AC. I was a young co-pilot at the time, and I said, "What is a bug doing at 30,000 feet?" And the best thing we could figure was he'd gotten caught up by an updraft in the thunderstorm and gotten blown up to high altitude.
A little hard for him to breathe up there. I remember going through the barometric chamber there at Miramar, and they took us up to 20,000 without any oxygen. And they waited till your fingers started turning blue, and then you put your mask on, all except that poor sucker that sat in seat number 13. And they handed him a chalkboard, and they told him to write his name. And he wrote his name, and they waited, maybe a minute, not very long, and told him to write his name again, and it was like in 12-inch letters. And then they told him to write it again, and he says, "I want my mommy," and he started to cry, and they slapped the oxygen on him.
You can't see color either. That's another indication, that you're losing, you're getting hypoxic. So it was always interesting. They'd put a color wheel in front of you, at which when you put your mask back on, you could see color again.
Yeah, I think Steve said, that's my nephew that flies 787, I think anything above 30,000, they have to put the oxygen mask on. It could be 40, but because those have the supersonic wings, they can go up to, between 40 and 50,000 now, I guess.
You know, for ID, in the military, if you were above 50, you had to have a pressure suit on, but your time of useful consciousness, when you get up, mid-30s up, it's in seconds. It's very small, and if you have a rapid decompression, it's even less.
Wow. Well, then they must have put that mask on him faster than I thought, but I remember him writing his name, and then he started crying. And, of course, that's been 50-some years ago. But I remember Fightertown, USA, we would abort from NAS North Island when I flew in the S-2s, and we'd abort to Miramar. And I always remember that hangar up there. And the Petries, we were up in Mountain View, California, near San Jose.
Connell, I did a tour at Castle Air Force Base, if you remember that base. But we taught guys to fly the 135 and the B-52. It's a huge training base for SAC.
But I can't remember it. I know when before I joined, I was offered an audition at Offutt Air Force Base for the Navy band there. And my dad didn't get me a pass on the railroad soon enough, and that really disappointed me. I played French horn, and that would have been a good gig with the Air Force.
Quarter sack, that would have been a pretty awesome thing. Yeah, Castle was in the San Joaquin Valley around Atwater, if you remember where that was. But we would launch early in the morning and fly missions up the west coast there, refueling, teaching guys how to do aerial refueling, and both the tankers and the bombers out over the coast over the water. And so we had long, long refueling tracks up there on the coast that went from, oh, maybe somewhere around Klamath Falls in Oregon all the way up to, you know, the upper parts of Washington State.
My brother-in-law was stationed at Whidbey Island in the P-2, the V Neptunes. I think he was a mechanic of some sort. But he had some stories to tell about them mapping the China coast back in the 50s. I think some of them was barricaded a little bit. But, those were long flights. The trade-off in the S-2 was you got off the ship, and then I got duty with my brother up in Moffett Field. The trade-off was it flew a maximum of 8 hours to 8.5, and there was four of us, and the P-3 had 13 of us, and we flew regularly 13-hour missions. Man, that'd get old, especially out over the Pacific.
Well, they had the wind tunnel test facility was there, and we had some Canadian pilots come down and visit us once, and we all loaded up in there. They had an old DC-3 they were still flying, and we were we all loaded up, went to Moffett Field, and airplane was flying so slow they had to put us into holding pattern so they could let all the faster jets get by, and then they could let us land.
They had F-4s there. I remember my brother describing one that landed there. They had long runways. I think 10,000 feet. But right next to Ames Research Center where they had that wind tunnel, and it blew a tire and had a wheel fire. And we always feared that also. But I never did have that happen. Had a stack blow one time. We'd been working a submarine out by San Clemente and Catalina in between there. And a stack fell down on the prop feathering pump, and you know how much fire comes out of those recips. And we got down rather quick. Captain Beck says, "Emergency, emergency, emergency, get me the hell down from here." And we was the last one in the pattern. And they said it wouldn't have been long. We wouldn't have had a wing.
Fires will definitely get your attention, I know that. I was pretty fortunate, though, and most of the didn't have any real serious emergencies while I was flying, but, you know, you lose an engine or something, but not really to a fire, you know, mechanical failure, or lost the linkage off of a throttle one time while I was refueling, and, you know, you shut the engine down, but it wasn't really anything overly dramatic.
Well, he was Lieutenant Beck, I should say. He was the captain of the airplane, but, we was getting ready to land, and we was on low fuel quantity, so, you know, the little red light comes on, and we was the last one in the Delta pattern, and as we were descending, he says, Rouse, he says, is this for real, or should I take it seriously? And I looked up there, and, you know, your engines are surrounded by thermocouples and that, and we had a firelight. And I said, he says, is there any smoke aft? And I said, no, sir. And he said, was this an electrician screw-up? And that's not exactly how he said it, but or should I take it seriously? I said, I'd get down, sir. And about that time, his VGI on his side tumbled, and it just rolled. And I could see it from where I was at because there were just four of us on that. And, man, he tipped that thing over and brought it in. And I think we caught the fourth wire that day. And that was, it didn't scare me at all because we didn't smell any smoke, of course, in the cabin. Yeah, but the next day they give us a shot of brandy, and the flight surgeon, and he says, drink that, and I drank it. Well, I'm not a drinker, and that felt like he was drinking alcohol. I mean, just, oh, wow, burned all the way down, and I said, what's that for? And he said, well, the mechanics tell me he had about 90 seconds to live yesterday, and I broke out in goosebumps.
Get a copy of that. That'll get your attention. I've had that a couple of times. I was had a battery fire one time when I was flying number two in formation with another tanker, and we were up northeast of Virginia, and we had two big old NICAT batteries in the airplane. One of them caught on fire, and we wound up making an emergency landing without radios into Raleigh-Durham Airport, and we shut the whole airport down for 2 hours.
That'll do it. Shoot. What are they doing? Squawk 7700? Is that what it is? I can't remember.
Yeah, we didn't do a whole lot of, weren't able to do a lot. We lost a lot of the electronics, you know. Started pulling circuit breakers to cut the power to the batteries, and wound up without any radio. And we lost intercom, too. So it was a few minutes before we figured out as crew members, you know, why isn't this guy next to me answering me? It was a pretty exciting time. Cockpit looked like a real mess when we got on the ground, KO4 LEO.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think we had, and I'm not, it's been so long, I can tell you different specifications on that S2 and the P3. We used 115, 145 av gas on the S2, 765 gallons, but the P3 had 9,200 gallons to P5, and each one of them engines was 4,600 shaft horsepower. The T56 Alphas back then. Well, they sure got some funny propellers on those things now. I remember those engines. We was overseas in the Philippines and Vietnam, and the crew members, after you landed, of course, you had to square away the aircraft, and I was the lucky one. I get to go up because I wasn't scared of heights, and I'd climb out on that engine nacelle and stick those dust covers on them, you know. And I'm telling you, those suckers were hot.
The new engines we put on the tanker, we had started out with the same engine the B-52 had, J-57s, and they were all water injection, you know, that's where all the black smoke would come from. In the early days, we carried 5,000 gallons of water, I think it was, and then you just inject that into the engines during takeoff, and that'd give you an extra 1,000 pounds of thrust per engine. But then we changed over to the CFM56, and that was a high bypass fan, and it gave us about a 70% increase in thrust and about a 90% reduction in noise. But boy, I tell you what, if you didn't manage the temperatures in those core engines carefully, you could wind up melting one down, and we did that on the early days.
This is NGLTR. It's amazing. Our daughter works for GE, and then Ariel NY4G is a good friend of ours, and he was here one day, and I said, I think they're making those big engines, the Rolls Royce, and I think they're Pratt Whitney's now, and the GE's, and the GE9X, I think they call it, is... I think it's 110,000 pounds of thrust now, Jim.
Good power plant. The ones we got, it was a joint venture between a French company called Snecma and GE. And they put out 25,000 pounds of thrust back then. You see them a lot on the 737 Southwest flies, but theirs have a flat bottom on them. Ours had, the generator was stuck on the bottom, and we learned pretty quick that that was not a good place to have it, because you didn't have much clearance when you went to land. You could only be in a 3-degree attitude for landing, and that didn't always work out too well for pilots. So they put the generator on the side, so when you look at them now, you can see on the side that it's got a flat bottom on it, so that makes it a lot easier to land in crosswinds.
I've noticed that they had to redesign that engine to make it that way. I remember that. But boy, they're a lot more efficient than they used to be in the old days. I think this 727, Steve flew 727s, MD-80s, 767. He went international and then 787s. Now he flies mostly from Dallas to Shanghai or South Korea. I got a picture of the, I think they got four big displays now, a glass cockpit. And he sent me a picture of the waypoints on the way to descending into Seoul, South Korea. He says, "You see that spot up there in the northwest side of that route?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "You don't want to go there." He says, "That's North Korea."
Singapore one morning into KC-10, and Malaysia's right north of us, and you did not want to be in their airspace. And so you had to make a hard turn right after takeoff coming out of the airport that I was at. But talking about power, the KC-10 was essentially an off-the-shelf purchase as a DC-10-30, and those engines put out 50,000 pounds apiece. We had three of them.
Yeah, that was quite an aircraft. My daughter just texted me here. I don't know what she said. She's expecting us to go to Sam's and come back, and we've been sitting here in the yard for a little while. Oh, shoot. Boy, I'll tell you, the good old days. Yeah, they, the power on those things now is incredible, and the altitudes have increased, and the composites have increased. Steve, when they landed the first one up in Oshkosh, he sent a picture of him on the ladder going up to the plane. You know, I had one of the portable ones, and he was pointing at me, and he says, "I'm going to fly this one day," and by golly, he did. And there he started out at Beechcraft. And then I think the Air Force sent him to fly T-38s down at, where was that at in Texas, San Antonio or someplace down there. They wanted him to be a fighter pilot. He come out top gun in his squadron, and he didn't want to. He wanted to fly commercially someday, so that's why he took 130s, and he's sure done it. We're proud of him. But very seldom ever get to see him. He'll send me a picture now and then from, kind of like you, from those far off places. You know, I remember landing at Wake Island and Midway as a kid. It didn't mean a lot to me. And now I wish I'd have known what I've learned since then, because I love history. And we didn't have a clue back then. I suppose the older pilots did, but older's a relative term. They weren't that old.
A lot of fun when I was a young guy. I didn't know how good I had it. Just being a line aircraft commander, you know, pushing a crew, pulling alert, and then going TDY was a lot of fun. Tom, I got to run. It's good to talk to you. I'm sure we'll talk more, but I'll be clear after your last.
Yes, the pleasure's all mine. I really enjoyed it. And, yeah, I've got cards here from QSL cards from Wake and Midway and different places, and they mean a lot to me now. And my brother and I went to Bataan and Corregidor when we were over there, and very meaningful now. Well, Jim, the pleasure's all mine. You have a nice day, and we're going to head down to the daughter's and take her some homemade breadsticks and take this dog cage back that we hauled our new chickens home in. We got eight new girls out there, as I call them, and they're doing just fine. Some speckled Sussex. shoot, it's kind of a hobby. Nothing big, but we like the eggs. 73 Jim. This is N0TR clear.
Well, KO4 LAO clear.